Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Bob Saldick, former chair and currently a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. It will be my pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Scott McClellan, former White House press secretary under President George W. Bush from 2003 to 2006, the author of What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Scott McClellan served as the White House press secretary from 2003 to 2006. Before that, he served as the principal deputy White House press secretary and as traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign. Earlier in his career, McClellan served as deputy communications director in the Texas governor's office, a top legislative aide and campaign manager for three successful statewide campaigns in Texas. Born in Austin, he graduated from the University of Texas. He now lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife, Jill. With great pleasure, I introduce to you Scott McClellan.
Thanks, Bob, for that introduction. It's great to be here in San Francisco. Pleased to see the great turnout today as well. It's been an interesting few weeks, to say the least. It really has been a whirlwind. I think the first couple of weeks, I didn't know whether I was in New York City or Washington, D.C., going back and forth doing all the interviews. Then I spent last week, the early part of last week, in Southern California before I had to cut the trip short and head back and testify before Congress on Friday. And of course, I was at the invitation of Chairman Conyers. Then I went to my hometown the next day, this last Saturday, of Austin, Texas. I had a great crowd there. And now I've been visiting the Northwest and the Northern, and of course, Northern California today. I came in from Seattle this morning, had a great event there last night as well. It has been a little exhausting at times over the last month since the first story broke about the book, but it has been enormously energizing and uplifting to have such strong support out across the country. Everywhere I've been traveling, people have been coming up to me, and I think they're looking at the larger message in the book, and I've been very pleased by the response to the larger message of the book, and I'm certainly pleased by the number of people that have turned out today with an interest in what I had to say in the book. Speaking of this past Friday's congressional testimony, I'm sure many of you either heard or read that Lamar Smith, the ranking minority member of the committee and a congressman also from my home state of Texas, tried to trivialize the issues in my book. Congressman Smith called the Judiciary Committee hearing a, quote, book of the month club. Well, after a little more thought, I've come to the conclusion that I endorse the idea. In fact, I've already been receiving some suggestions from people. Some think that the next book we should see before the committee would be by Karl Rove. Maybe. Maybe entitled The Lies I Told to Whom and Why. Then some suggested we could have Dick Cheney's book before the committee, Dick Cheney himself, No More Secrets, or maybe the title could be called I Upped Halliburton's Income, So Up Yours. Scooter Libby's book might take a line from Steve Martin and called, Well, Pardon Me. Finally, since Lamar Smith claimed that one of my editors had called President Bush a, quote, clearly horrible person, when in fact it turned out that the remark was actually made by his daughter, someone suggested Congressman Smith's book be called How Scott McClellan Taught Me to Check My Facts Before I Speak. I imagine many of you have probably seen or heard enough of me over the last few weeks. I know I've seen and heard more of me than I cared to over the last few weeks, and I do see that there are a lot of questions there, and so I'll try to keep my remarks relatively brief, but there are several things I'd like to talk about in the book that the book talks about as well. You know, most of the comments that were made by some of the Republican members, there are actually a few Republican members that were very courteous last week. Congressman Issa said, despite the fact that he didn't agree with it, that it was a well-written book, and I appreciated that. But most of the comments made by some Republicans on the Judiciary Committee were simply rehashing and replaying some of the initial reaction from the White House and some of its allies, including some of my former colleagues. And they were describing what was in the book. When they hadn't even read the book, they were trying to describe my motivations, the motivations behind writing it, and the comments and the reaction really made one of my key points that I talk about in the book, and that is about the unsavory side of national politics today, the side that turns many Americans off and has led to so much dismay across the country about the way Washington is governing today. I received plenty of criticism for daring to tell the story as I knew it and as I lived it. Yet few of my critics, few of them tried to refute the larger themes and perspectives in my book, and I have seen few try to challenge the events as I describe them in the book as well, or engage in a reasoned and rational and honest discussion of what I believe are very important issues. Instead, they sought to turn the book into this game of gotcha politics that we see too often in Washington, misrepresenting what I wrote and instead waging inaccurate personal attacks on me. And I actually found some of the initial reaction from critics somewhat amusing. It went from everything to I was having an out-of-body experience to somehow I had been beaten into submission by the liberal New York book publishing world, and they forced me to write everything that I did. But I believe the American people deserve better than what we're getting from some of those in Washington who seek to trivialize these important issues and turn them into the latest example of gotcha politics. And make no mistake, and I talk about this in the book, governing inevitably has an adversarial element to it. People and groups are always going to differ about the proper use of limited government resources. But one core question I ask is, should government be a process of constant campaigning to manipulate public opinion, or should it be centered as much as possible on rational debate, deliberation, and compromise? And that really goes to the larger message in my book, which is about restoring civility and transcending partisanship, and most importantly, encouraging candor to be restored to the political process and the national political discourse, especially from our elected leaders. We need to move beyond the poisonous atmosphere in Washington, D.C., end the destructive excesses of the permanent campaign culture, including this philosophy that politics is should be viewed as war between the two parties, and us versus them, they're the enemy, they're the bad guys, and focus on improving the way Washington works and governs. And I'm pleased, by the way, people have been responding to that now that we've gotten beyond the initial reaction to the book to a large degree. And I'm someone that tends to look for the good in people. I think that most people on both sides of the aisle that come to Washington, D.C. are good people, and they come there for the right reasons. Unfortunately, too many of us get caught up in this whole atmosphere in Washington, the whole permanent campaign culture. And the larger message of my book is really bigger than any one person or any party. It is about putting our nation's interest above partisan goals. It is about how all of us, but especially our elected leaders, can really work to do more to make that happen by promoting openness and engaging in reasoned and rational discourse. The permanent campaign now promotes just the opposite. Substantive debates over policy give way to a contest over which side can most effectively manipulate the narrative to its advantage. Is about power in the next election. Governing becomes an offshoot of campaigning rather than the other way around. And as I talk about in the book, the permanent campaign is not something that began with this administration. It has certainly been building for decades and embraced by previous administrations to varying degrees, particularly in about the last 30, 40 years. The reason it is important to understand it is because of how troubling it can become when that kind of mentality is transferred into the war-making process. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I do want to step back for a minute and talk about my upbringing and my background, because I think it's important to understand that in order to understand the perspective that I am coming from. A lot of people choose to get involved in politics, and there are a lot of good people that do so. I was actually born into politics when I was 4 years old. My mother was elected to the Austin School Board. She went on to become the first woman president of the Austin School Board. And by the time I was in the third grade, she had been elected mayor of Austin. This is in the late 70s. There weren't a lot of big city mayors at that point. She went on to serve an unprecedented three terms at the time. Now, in Texas, local officials are elected on a nonpartisan basis. But I did grow up in a Democratic family. And I had three older brothers. I'm the youngest of the bunch. And we were taught at a very early age the importance of public service and the importance of speaking up and the importance of doing what you believe is right to make a positive difference. It wasn't until it was the mid-80s when my mother actually switched parties. And it's just as I was becoming a voting age, I switched parties as well. But we've always come at things from more of a centrist perspective about problem solving and compromising to get things done. Now, my granddad, in many ways, was the patriarch of our family. My grandfather taught at the University of Texas School of Law for most of his life, and he was actually dean there for 25 years, really helped take it to a position of national prominence. But my granddad used to say to us, and it's something that has always stuck with me as well as my brothers, it's not the dollars you make, it's the difference you make. And that is something that has always guided us throughout our time, whatever our career path may have been. Certainly my career path was public service and politics. But there's also one favorite story I have of my grandfather, and I didn't hear this till several years ago, shortly after he had passed away, from a family friend. Who had actually attended the University of Texas School of Law. And he talked about a class that my granddad was speaking to. It was a pre-law class that my granddad was giving a lecture to, and in the big theater-style seating in the room at the University of Texas School of Law. And my granddad posed the question to the students, well, what do you think makes a good lawyer? And with little hesitation, one student in the back of the room jumped up and said, well, Dean Keaton, I believe in right is right and wrong is wrong and good triumphs over evil. Do you think I'll make a good lawyer? My granddad looked back up at him and without missing a beat said, no, but you'll make a good Batman. and my granddad had this great wit about him. He was, of course, making the point that the law and legal issues are not black and white issues. And I don't think politics often, neither is politics to a large degree. Too often in Washington today, complex issues are reduced to stark black and white terms, and then they're oversimplified in the context of winners and losers and how they're going to affect the next election. The focus is on who's up and who's down instead of who's right and who's wrong and what's the underlying truth behind it and how does it affect the American people. Vicious negative attacks, distortions, political manipulation, spin become accepted within Washington's culture. And the national media, unwittingly becomes complicit in this. They're not responsible for creating this environment. The people who are responsible for it are elected leaders, and they're the ones that need to take action to move us beyond it. But the media too often becomes complicit in focusing foremost on the Beltway game, and then lionizing and holding those up that most skillfully play that game. And when the permanent campaign becomes excessively embraced as the primary means for governing, then we see how deeply troubling it becomes when it is used to take the country into war, as this administration did with Iraq. I'm someone who believes from a moral standpoint that we should not be going to war unless it's absolutely necessary. And the war in Iraq was not absolutely necessary. There are other... Thank you. There are other ways we could have confronted Saddam Hussein, but this president put us on a course that was very inflexible. It was either he comes clean or we go to war. There was no in between. Now, at the time, I was serving as the principal deputy press secretary, as Bob mentioned in his opening remarks, during the buildup to the war. And like a lot of Americans, I was concerned about how quickly we were moving to war with Iraq, particularly when Iraq didn't have anything to do with the September 11th attacks. But like a lot of Americans, I was also willing to trust the administration at this time to give the president and his foreign policy team the benefit of the doubt. This was a foreign policy team that was at the time very highly regarded for what they had done in the invasion with Afghanistan, the initial invasion and the toppling of the Taliban there. And they were the ones who certainly had the access to the intelligence and supposedly knew the regime very well and what its intentions were, and I didn't have the access at that point to this intelligence. It was not really until I left the White House and went through the process of really thinking this through, researching my book, reflecting on that time, that I realized how badly misplaced my trust was in this administration in that regard. It took stepping back from the White House for me to be able to see things clearly. It was not easy to do, given the length of time that I'd worked for the president. He was someone that I became very close to personally, and it was tough to separate that personal closeness to the president from his policies, from his governance, and from his leadership. But that's what I was able to do as I went through writing this book. And certainly, I'd placed a lot of hope and trust initially in the president. When I went to work for him in Texas, a lot of people don't remember this today, and then I understand why. But the president was a very popular bipartisan governor of Texas. He was someone who had 70% plus approval rating for much of his tenure in Texas. He worked across the aisle with the Democratic lieutenant governor. He worked across the aisle with the Democratic Speaker of the House in his first term to get a lot of things done for the state, and that's why he was his approval ratings were so high. And it's the reason I was attracted to go to work for him in the first place. Here was this bipartisan leader that I believed, and I was an idealistic and young person at the time, I think about 30 years old when I first went to work for him, but I believed that maybe he could bring that same sort of bipartisan spirit to Washington, D.C. He ran as someone you remember in the 2000 campaign that was committed to doing that, too. He talked about changing the tone. He talked about being a uniter, not a divider, and he talked about moving us beyond the permanent campaign in Washington, D.C. And I think when the president came to Washington, he decided, I'm going to make a little bit of an effort to do what I pledged I was going to do in the campaign. But it's clear to me today that he was more determined to play the game in Washington under the existing rules, the way everyone else was playing it, or most people were playing it, rather than transforming it. And I think part of this goes back to learning the wrong lessons from what he saw happen to his father. His father, certainly one of the things I talk about in the book, I talk about some of the turning points that led us to this very bitter environment in Washington and the excessive partisanship that goes on today. One of the turning points I talk about was the 1988 campaign when his father was running for president. And his father is certainly someone that I think believes in civility and believes in civil discourse to a large extent. But his advisors, his political advisors, convinced him that the only way he could beat Dukakis was to accentuate the negative. The whole strategy was about tearing Michael Dukakis down, who was initially perceived as someone who governed more towards the center, even though he was to the left of center, he governed more towards the center. What happened was that they decided they were going to paint him far out of the mainstream, paint him far to the left, question his patriotism, or raise at least by implication, question his patriotism, if not directly. And what happened was that that campaign became so bitter and so negative that I think it carried over into the governance in Washington. It didn't stop when the campaign ended. Now, for the president, I think when he got in there, President Bush 41, that is, for him, it stopped to an extent. He didn't want to engage in some of the more unsavory side of politics. He didn't like all the political stuff as much. And I think that his son, the current president, looked at that and viewed it as a reason why he lost re-election because of the way he moved back to a more civil discourse once he got in office, yet the other side still harbored some ill will because of how bitter and nasty that election turned out. And so I think that the current president was determined when he came into office, I'm not going to let that happen to me. And he excessively embraced the political side more so than his father did when he was in office and embraced some of the more unsavory tactics that his father often shunned once he got into office. And as I worked on the book and looked back at the buildup to the war, one of the things that I did was look back and say, was it simply the decision to go to war that was the reason that this administration went so badly off course? Was it simply the decision that why the president's popularity is so low today? Or was it something more? Was it the way we took the nation to war? And by embracing a political marketing campaign or political propaganda campaign to sell it to the American people, and in the process, what happened was that the administration shunned candor and openness with the American people. And I think that's the reason, as much as any other, that this president has lost public trust, and it has been so low for so long. I get asked often about whether I think it was a deliberate campaign to mislead the American people. I don't think that the president and his top advisors were sitting in a room during the build-up to the war, certainly not Colin Powell and others like that, sitting around saying, let's figure out how we can mislead the American people into war. Now, I can't vouch for every individual or every individual's motives and intent, and certainly those are questions that remain because of some of the actions that we've seen, and some of the suspicion remains because of the lack of transparency within this administration. But the focus among the president and his top advisors became, how do we make the strongest case for taking the nation to war? And in the process, they believed that they could market the war to the American people, much like we did education reforms, much like we did tax cuts, and much like we later would do with Social Security. It was all about selling it to the American people and not embracing a high level of openness and candor and not talking openly about the truth of the situation as best we knew it at the time, talking about the qualifications, talking about the caveats in the intelligence, and talking with the American people about the consequences, the cost, and the risk of going to war in a very open manner. Back in early September 2002, I remember White House Chief of Staff Andy Card went out and said, you don't begin a marketing campaign in August, and that's why we stepped up the effort to sell war to the American people beginning in September of 2002, but we began laying the groundwork much before that. And then, of course, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz later said publicly that the one issue that everybody could agree on was about weapons of mass destruction. Now, he also acknowledged that there was some disagreement about the connections to terrorism, which, of course, made it a more urgent and serious threat to sell to the American people. And the White House Iraq Group was something that was set up as we began to sell war to the American people. It was the marketing arm of selling that war to the American people, a strategic communications group that included all the top advisors for the president as well, including the foreign policy team and the top communicators. Now, in build-up to the war, again, I was deputy. I participated in a couple of those meetings when my predecessor was out of town at the time and filled in for him from time to time in this effort to sell war to the American people. But it wasn't until later when I became press secretary that I was participating in that meeting on a regular basis. And it's not a meeting, again, where people are sitting around in a sinister way saying, let's figure out how we can deceive the American people. But it was very much focused on how do we make the strongest case? How do we go about doing this with the American people? And they forgot about the importance of making sure during the war-making process, you've got to talk about, give the American people the truth as best you know it. And I think the recently released report by the Senate Intelligence Committee came out shortly after my book. It reached very much the same conclusions that I came to in my book, pointing out that much of the intelligence could be substantiated to some degree, but that in making the case, the administration overstated it and overpackaged the intelligence, especially when it came to implying a relationship with al-Qaeda, which could not be substantiated. So we took the nation to war by making it sound more urgent, more serious, and more grave than it actually was. It was not this idea of out-and-out deception, but shading of the truth, downplaying the major reason for going to war, which I can get to in some of the questions if you want to talk about, and emphasizing a lesser motivation that could be dealt with in other ways short of military confrontation, and trying to make the WMD threat and connection to terrorism a little more certain, a little less questionable than they were, quietly ignoring or disregarding crucial caveats and qualifications in the intelligence, and using innuendo and implication to encourage Americans to believe some things as fact that were unclear and possibly false, including the idea that Saddam Hussein had an active nuclear weapons program and a partnership with al-Qaeda. You might remember, of course, the vice president probably went further out than anybody on some of the intelligence at one point early in the process, saying that Saddam Hussein is amassing weapons of mass destruction to use against people in the region, to use against our allies, and to use against the United States. Well, the truth is, we know the intelligence today was also saying Saddam Hussein is a survivalist. He wants to hold on to his power. He wants to hold on to his regime. And the last thing he wants to do is stir up the United States by attacking the United States, which would invoke a very strong response and probably cost him his power. But the goal became about winning the debate by shaping the narrative to get Congress and the public behind the decision as we pursued the goal and embracing honesty and candor with the American people. about the potential war, its objectives, its the full truth behind the intelligence, and its cost and risk became a distant second in that process. What happened was that we confused the political propaganda campaign with the realities of the war-making campaign, and as it was focused more on creating the sense of gravity and urgency about the threat rather than governing on the basis of the truth of the situation. And that's what's deeply troubling. And that's why I talk about the culture in Washington, D.C., and look at certainly the responsibility lies with the president. But the culture, when it accepts this certain level of spin and political manipulation, then we see how dangerous it becomes when it's transferred into that war-making process. And one of the most important things I think that a president must do is not only build bipartisan support when you're taking the nation to war, but you must also be able to sustain it. And the reason we could not sustain it was because we did not embrace openness and candor with the American people. And the president, after the fact, when it turned out that the intelligence was wrong, could not bring himself to acknowledge mistakes because of the questions he was concerned about it would raise if he did so and what it might cost him politically. So he could not sustain that bipartisan support when our troops most needed it and when it could have helped form a basis for bringing this war to a quicker resolution, to a quicker end. One of the things when the Iraq study group came out, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, I actually sent word to the White House, said you should embrace that. Maybe it's a bipartisan way to move this process forward and bring this war to a responsible end. But whether or not it was deliberate or not in terms of the way we took the nation to war, when you have a culture in Washington that accepts or allows that kind of deception that is grounded in political manipulation and spin to occur, then it highlights a major problem about the way Washington governs today. And we should also be asking about using that in other realms as well, in the domestic policy and so forth. But I got caught up in this destructive culture, just like so many others do, and I certainly put plenty of blame at my own doorstep for some of the problems. This was, you know, the cultural problem does not remove any responsibility in any way from the president or the White House. But if we are to prevent a repeat of the mistakes, we must understand and learn from this culture in Washington, D.C. And it was probably the Valerie Plame leak episode, more than any other, that and the revelations that later came out about it that helped to open my eyes a little bit about this administration. The final 10 months of my time as press secretary was an increasing period of disillusionment. You will remember that I went out and publicly, shortly after I became press secretary, just as an investigation was getting underway into the leaking of her or the revealing of her identity to reporters, I had become press secretary. I was not press secretary when her identity was actually revealed. But I had to defend the White House, and I publicly stated that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, as well as another individual who it turned out he told me the truth, had not been involved in the revealing of her identity, that they had given me assurances. And it was in July of 2005, about 2 years later, when media reports first started to circulate that, well, in fact, Karl Rove had been involved in talking to reporters. First, it was Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, a White House correspondent at the time, and then it had been the second confirming source for Robert Novak's column as well. And it was a few weeks later we learned that Scooter Libby had been involved in that as well to other reporters. It was a very painful experience for me. And a lot of people ask me, well, why didn't you, or did you think about resigning at that time? And I did. I actually did think about resigning at that time. But it was two of my senior colleagues on the staff that had misled me. It wasn't the president. The president, I believe, had been misled by those individuals as well, and I recount some of the conversations I have with him, or had with him at the time in the book that leads me to those conclusions. Now, in terms of the vice president's involvement, there's a lot we don't know about it. There's a lot of suspicion that remains. But then there was a series of smaller events over the course of the next several months that led to some further disillusionment. And certainly during the initial Valerie Plame leak episode, what happened was that made it so tough was when the White House counsel's office said, well, this is an ongoing matter, ongoing investigation. You cannot comment about it from the podium. So I couldn't defend or set the record straight about my previous comments. And a spokesman cannot survive in an environment like that, though I thought maybe I could. I had very strong relations with White House reporters. In fact, it was during that time when I couldn't defend myself, that some White House reporters, actually some of my toughest nemeses in the briefing room, stepped forward and in their reporting said, well, he's in a tough spot, we understand that, but he's got to be able to set the record straight. But at the same time, they said, things like, well, his credibility is unquestionable. He is a straight shooter with us. But because he can't set the record straight, it's a real problem. And it was. But I think in some ways deceived myself, thinking that I could survive without being able to set the record straight from some of those comments. But then a series of other incidents occurred. One of the most unusual, or one of the ones that I never would have expected when I took over as press secretary, was, of course, that I would be there when a second vice president was involved in a shooting incident. And, of course, I find out about that a little bit late, several hours into it, as I'm waking up early Sunday morning and said the vice president shot him. That was kind of my initial reaction. And immediately I started saying, well, he needs to get that information out to the National Press Corps and get it out right away. I was on the phone with Dan Bartlett, the counselor at the time overseeing communications, and we both agreed that the best strategy would be for the vice president to, he was down in Corpus Christi or outside Corpus Christi, so there's no national press with him. Okay, well, we'll assemble a phone call with a group of reporters, a pool, so they can share it with the rest of the National Press Corps and get that information out right away so it doesn't look like there's anything to hide or no reason to hide anything. And the vice president took our advice, and about 8 hours later, about 18 hours after the incident, decided, well, I'll give it to the Corpus Christi Caller Times. And it showed up on their website where national reporters could go and find it if they heard about it. And then for 3 days, of course, I was out there taking a lot of slings and arrows because the vice president wouldn't say anything about it. And he wouldn't share much information with me either. It's kind of his regard for the press is very low, to say the least. He didn't want to say anything about it. And, Dan and I were talking to the president, and the president was talking, saying with the vice president, we need to get him out there. He needs to get out there and answer these questions. It's continuing to be an issue at the podium and an issue in Washington. And the president, this is emblematic of, I think, one of the ways the president showed too much deference to the vice president. The president, instead of directing him to go out there, said, "Well, you got to kind of make it feel like it's the vice president's idea to go out there and do this." I never quite understood that. And it wasn't until that Wednesday, and I remember standing outside the Oval Office right before we were going into a meeting that Wednesday morning with the vice president. And we were sitting there visiting, and he looked at me, and I was glad he was finally getting out there. And he said, "Well, yeah, you know what? I picked Fox News to do this." And I looked at him, and I said, "Because I want, when the rest of the media reports this, they're going to have to cite Fox News when they do so." And he had a little chuckle at that. But at any rate, that was a tough period. And then, the most disillusioning moment for me was in early April of 2006, when it became known through legal proceedings that Patrick Fitzgerald had released that the president had secretly authorized the vice president, and no one else knew about this, not the chief of staff, not the national security advisor, not the director of central intelligence, secretly authorized the vice president to anonymously get out parts of the national intelligence estimate on Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. Now, this didn't include Valerie Plame, that she was not in that part of things, but we had been out there for years. I had been out there for the president. The president had been out there decrying the selective leaking of classified information. And here we were doing the very same thing that we had been decrying publicly for so long. Now, the president has the full authority to declassify anything he wants at any time. And it was actually about 10 days later when we formally declassified that document through the formal process. But no one else knew about it except the president, vice president, and Scooter Libby, who the vice president asked to quietly get some information out to reporters in the effort to discredit Joe Wilson in his criticism of the administration. And, some could say that that may have created a permissive environment for the anonymous leaking of Valerie Plame's identity. I don't know, and again, I don't think the president had anything to do with that, but it certainly encouraged this anonymous counterpunching when it came to Joe Wilson. But you really tend to lose perspective when you. I was going to mention in the National Intelligence Estimate how I found out. It was that morning. It was breaking in the press. We had been traveling to North Carolina for another event. President's getting back on Air Force One, and a reporter yells out at him, "Mr. President, something to the effect, were you the one that authorized the leaking of the National Intelligence Estimate?" And the president went into his office. I followed him up the stairs, walking to the office in the front of Air Force One there, and he looked at me. He said, what were they yelling out there? And I said, he was asserting that you authorized the leaking of the National Intelligence Estimate for Scooter Libby to do that. And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, I did." And I was, you know, taken aback. I didn't know much about it at that point since it was just breaking in the news and we had been in another event. And he clearly didn't want to talk about it more. I went back to the senior staff area in Air Force One where my seat usually was and started to find out more information about it. And that was, I'd kind of made up my mind in that period that, you know, I could no longer stand up there and speak for the president and do this because I keep getting undermined from within. And now at the same time, we were going through a change. The new White House chief of staff was coming in, and he was looking to make some changes. So my time for leaving the White House was sped up a little bit. But what happens is when you get in Washington, and I think it's hard for some people to understand, you really do it's easy to lose perspective on things. You get caught up inside this bubble of the White House and the Washington, the partisan wars in Washington, D.C. Writing this book was not easy for me to do. I really had to step back from it all, remove my partisan lens to take a clear-eyed look at events. And some of the conclusions that I came to were not ones that I may have embraced at the beginning of writing the book. At the beginning of writing the book, I initially started out, how did this popular bipartisan governor become one of the most polarizing and controversial presidents in history, modern history at least? That's where I started from, and it emerged from there. And I initially wanted to look at pointing responsibility elsewhere. But the responsibility lies with this president, lies with this White House. And that's where I ended up with many of my conclusions. But I did not write this book because these were easy things to say. I wrote it because I really want to see Washington change the way it governs for the better, and I really want to make sure that we do not repeat these same mistakes that this White House made. And I don't claim to have a monopoly on the truth in any way, but I believed it was important for me to openly share my experiences. And this is the truth as best I know it from my perspective, what I lived, what I learned from it, and hopefully, and I think I'm very pleased by how well it has taken off, because hopefully in some small way it will make a positive difference to do that. And you know, a lot of people talk about loyalty as well, and there was a lot of personal loyalty I had to this president, but this book reflects the only idea of loyalty that I believe is appropriate in a democratic government, and that is loyalty to the ideals of candor, transparency, and integrity, and indeed to the constitutional system itself. It's about, there's no more important loyalty than to the truth and to the American people. Too often in Washington today, people mistakenly think that loyalty to an individual office holder should override loyalty to those basic ideals. This false loyalty is not only mistaken, but it can exercise, as we see, a corrupt influence on government itself. And I must say, though, before I go, before I go to your questions, I'm an optimistic guy. I still have that optimism in me. I know a lot of people think that Washington will never change, that this is just the way it is, and I disagree very strongly. I think it's a matter of time before it does happen. When you get the right president in there who is willing to embrace a high level of openness with the American people, a high level of candor, and fully committed to making it happen, it's difficult once you get in there. I was pleased that a political reporter for the Washington Post wrote an article saying that the people that should most read this book right now are probably the ones that have the least amount of time to do so. And he was referring to the people on both of the presidential campaigns because their experience is probably a lot like mine. They have all this idealism and hope about their candidate and think that they can come in and change things for the better. And I have no illusion about how difficult, how bitter and how ugly political campaigns can get. But it is that problem when that transfers over into the governance and it doesn't stop and it continues. And if you don't have a plan from day one when you come into office, then you're probably not going to be able to change things the way you had envisioned. I'm encouraged by the talk on the presidential campaign. About 2 weeks before my book came out, I was pleased to see Senator McCain talking about ending the permanent campaign. I'm not sure you can end it, but you can minimize its excesses. You've got to have a strong counterbalance to the political forces inside any White House. There's always going to be a huge political operation that exists, and you got to have a counterweight to minimize that influence. Senator Obama, of course, from the beginning, has been talking about changing the way Washington works. it's a theme that is very similar to the one this president ran on in 2000 when he talked about being a uniter, not a divider. So I'm encouraged by that talk, but we need to be asking the candidates the specific questions about how they're going to make that happen. It's one thing to talk about it. It's very difficult once you get in there. I want to thank you for coming out today. Thank you for the interest in the book. I look forward to the questions.
Our thanks to Scott McClellan for his comments today. And, Scott, we have a lot of questions, so let me plunge in.
So you're sorting them all out.
I'm trying. A lot of the questions really focus on you and your emotions and when you exactly – what was the moment of epiphany that you decided to do this, write this book. Let me just give you a plug. I read this book, and I urge all of you to look at it and read it, because if you think you can absorb it from a short talk, you can't. Scott really – penetrated. So what I'd like you to do is to tell us about how you decided to write this book and what the reaction has been. A lot of people are asking about Republican reaction to it, the White House. Have you, what's going on? We're reading a lot about the attacks on you, but what about from your standpoint?
There are actually a number of former colleagues, both inside the White House and or that were at the White House and inside the other parts of the administration, that have been very supportive. They don't necessarily agree with what I wrote, but they know who I am, and they've been sending me words of encouragement and support. So I've been pleased by that. And the reaction on the street has been, like I said, you never know when you finish the book. It's out of your control at that point. Are people going to respond to the larger message and themes in the book? And as far as I can see, people are. They're understanding it. A lot of Republicans, even Republicans, come up to me. I had a woman the other day who was in her 80s, said she had voted Republican. She was at the airport. Said she had voted Republican all her life. And in fact, she was from Southern California, I believe. And she said, but not this time. There's a lot of dismay out there. There's a lot of thank you. And it's on both sides of the aisle. I think both sides of the aisle are ready to move beyond some of the bitterness that has existed now for the better part of two decades. Started even before we came into office, and we didn't make it any better. But this book was a process. It wasn't just one moment where I said, oh, you know, I was wrong on a lot of this, or I was wrong to believe a lot of these people. It was thinking through these issues. I think when people read this book, you know, some try to ascribe motives that, oh, he's bitter, he's disgruntled. I think when people read this book, they look at it and they don't see anything bitter about it. They see someone who really wants to make a difference and change things for the better. And the only way I know how to do that is by sharing my experiences with people. I would hope that this would encourage more people on the inside to write this kind of book and share their experiences openly. I'm afraid that it won't in this White House, unfortunately. Maybe someday it will. But the American people need to understand these truths so that we can all be better off for it.
We have many questions about the Iraq War. And in your book, you really carefully try to explain the Iraq War as it was started by the president and by his associates. So two questions. Could you explain to the audience now why they were so anxious to go to war with Iraq? And secondly, do you think – a question from the audience – do you think that the principal architects of Iraq policy, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz, privately now conclude that that was a mistake?
Okay. Well, a couple of things. First, in terms of – the first part was about going to the war.
Yeah.
There are a number of individuals, the Vice President, Secretary Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, some of the neoconservative thinkers within the White House that and even the President, had Iraq on the radar screen from the beginning. And the President certainly had there are a number of things that I talk about in terms of his disdain for tyrants and his disdain for Saddam Hussein that certainly come into play into that thinking. Now, one of the things I talk about in this book, too, is the way the President's an instinctive leader. As he likes to say, you know, when you're president, you've got to know your principles, you've got to know your philosophy, you can't figure it out once you're in office. And, you know, in some ways that's admirable. In other ways, I think it's a part of the problem as well. But when he makes a policy decision, he doesn't expect any. He's fine with people questioning the policy or dissenting before the decision is made. But once the decision is made, he expects everybody to follow in lockstep and not question the policy. They can question how it's being implemented, but not question the policy once he comes to that decision. And he had obviously made a decision to confront Saddam Hussein early on in the aftermath of September 11th, even if he had some ideas before September 11th as well. And there are certainly a number of individuals, the Vice President, Secretary Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, others, that instead of challenging his instincts, encouraged those instincts and pushed them in a certain direction. But it's the president that makes the decision and bears responsibility more than anyone else. And one of the things I talk about, too, is Secretary, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. I think too often she was too accommodating of the president's thinking rather than exposing him to different views and ideas and thoughts and bringing in people that would question it. Again, he had set that course to go into Iraq from very early on. What was the second part of the question?
Whether any of them regretted it at this point.
Oh, any of them regret it. One thing I do talk about, I don't know. It's hard to get in their heads, and it's hard to get in the heads of some of those that were pushing the president forward on this and know exactly what their true motivations were. Obviously, if Iraq didn't have vast oil reserves, it wouldn't be a national security concern. It wouldn't be on the radar screen. You can't discount that as well. And in the president's mind, certainly his faith plays into this to some extent in the sense that he believes everybody has the right to live in freedom. Again, another admirable thing that he's passionate about, but it's a question of how you go about doing that. Do you support efforts for people that want to live free and in a democratic state, or do you go in and do it coercively? The president, the driving motivation for this president, I would learn when I became press secretary more than anything else, was this belief, this idealistic and ambitious vision that we could coercively go into Iraq and implant democracy there, that it would be the linchpin for transforming the rest of the Middle East. That was the driving motivation, and that he would secure a great legacy someday for doing so. That in a time of war, it's this attitude that's a time for great transformation, and he saw an opportunity to achieve greatness. We don't know what history is going to say 50 years from now, but it doesn't change what I wrote in this book and the mistakes that were made. And in terms of if anyone regrets it, some of the individuals around the president, I don't think they've given it a second thought. The president, I know, and I talk about in this book, I know I really believe this. If he had a crystal ball and could look into the future and seen what had happened today in terms of more than 4,100 troops killed, in terms of at least upwards of 80 or 90,000 innocent Iraqis, and the high end of that is upwards of hundreds of thousands in terms of the innocent Iraqis who have been killed, I don't think he would have made the decision. I think he would have not gone to war in the first place, and that's from knowing him very well.
The Niger effort, the uranium-seeking in Niger was something you talk about at great length in the book, and we have innumerable questions about that and the Valerie Plame disclosures. Suppose Libby had told you that he said what he told the reporters about Valerie Plame. What could you or would you have done?
If who had told me?
Yeah. Louis Libby.
If he had told me what he had done?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He told me he didn't do anything. That was part of the problem. I asked him unequivocally, were you involved in this in any way, which is what I also asked Karl Rove, and I got the same response from both, that no, they were not involved in this in any way. I blame myself in looking back on this for putting myself in that position. But in terms of Scooter Libby, I was directed at the direction of the president and vice president through the White House chief of staff to publicly exonerate him, to give the same assurances I had for Karl Rove for Scooter Libby. And I don't think the president knew about his involvement when I was directed to do that. He was doing that at the urging of the vice president, and Scooter Libby was certainly involved in that, as I testified under oath on Friday before the House Judiciary Committee. But if I had learned something like that, I would have been under obligation, I think, to share it with the investigators, the FBI, the prosecutors, and that we were telling everybody internally, if you got information, share it with the investigators. That was one of the problems, too, and I'll do this real quick, but I don't think any president has truly learned the lessons of Watergate since it happened. I talk about the scandal culture in Washington, part of the excesses of the permanent campaign, and there's almost this mentality now in White Houses, and I saw it in this White House, that instead of embracing openness and addressing controversy head on and doing it yourself, getting to the bottom of it, disclosing as much you can. Now, there might be some rights that people have if they were involved in criminal activity or something unsavory, and you could work your way around that. But dealing with it yourself before it becomes a full-fledged scandal and before it goes to outside investigators. Instead, what happens is that too often White Houses, I think, decide, we've got to protect the president. Keep him away from any guilty knowledge of the unsavory things that are going on. And it's absolutely the wrong lesson to take away from Watergate. And every president has fallen prey to that to some extent, as I talk about in the book.
That is really depressing.
Well, it's the reason why there's so much suspicion about this administration. It's the reason why the partisan warfare has only increased over the last few years.
Let's switch to an easier subject. The press secretary's job, it's a tough spot to be in. Here's some questions. Based on your experiences, what changes would you recommend for the role of presidential press secretary?
I look forward to talking to some of my successors. I went to some of my predecessors from both parties before I took over as press secretary. It was something I really, and it's something I talk about in a chapter in the book. I struggled with whether or not I should actually go through with being press secretary. When my predecessor announced about 2.5 years into it that he was going to be leaving, I visited with the president and quickly accepted the job. But we didn't announce it for a while, and I kept pushing the announcement off. And the reason why I kept pushing it off was because I wasn't sure if I wanted to go forward with it. And the reason why, more than anything else, was because I wasn't sure if I'd have the flexibility to do the job the way I wanted to do it. And any spokesman, to a large extent, is going to reflect the person you're serving and their wishes and their desires. You speak for their policies and their decisions. But I struggled with it, knowing that this White House and this president did not want to change things as we were coming into an election year, and that they only wanted the press spokesman to share a limited amount of information for the most part, on the more controversial topics. But the first thing I would tell, and I've actually told this to one person who thinks that he might be in line for being press secretary in the next administration, I won't say which, but someone did approach me, and I said, well, the most important thing for you to do is to make sure you get assurance from the president that you will have access to any meeting at any time, any place, inside the White House, anytime you so choose. I certainly had a lot of access, full access to the president when I needed to see him. But this White House is so secretive and so compartmentalized, and it's hard for people to understand this, that I would be participating in policy briefings, I would be participating in world leader meetings, congressional meetings, cabinet meetings, but on some of the more consequential decisions, the decisions were made in a very small group of 2 or 3 people, maybe with the president. And so I didn't have a good sense sometimes of the driving motivations behind some of what I was saying. I had to rely on the word of others. But that's first and foremost, that they need to have access to any meeting, anytime they choose to be in a meeting, so that they can understand those true motivations. And there's certainly other things that I would advise them as well. I won't go into a great lengthy thing here so we can get to more questions.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. Scott, let's talk about the media a little bit. Multiple questions from the audience. What responsibility does the media have for buying into the Bush White House disastrous lies? How can the media do a better job in the future to ensure that the people are informed truthfully? And let me throw in a couple of other pieces of this. A questioner adds, how intensive was the Bush censorship of the media, or did it exist when reporters asked tough questions? Were they pushed to ask soft questions? You speak in the book of where you talked about shaping the narrative. What was your job in these terms, shaping the narrative from the administration?
Let me start with the national media. And I don't single out White House reporters in this book, and there's one primary reason why. In fact, I see one here today, a former White House reporter. They do a great job. They're very professional. They work hard. But they have a very thick wall and a tall wall that was built by this White House in terms of sharing information. It's a very difficult job covering particularly this White House, any White House to some extent, to try to crack through that wall and get on the inside. In fact, I talk about sometimes I was outside that wall myself, which is a problem in itself. But my concern with the media is not whether or not there's any bias. In fact, one of the things I talk about in the book, I actually welcome a liberal media as long as they are fair, because a liberal media is going to be more skeptical of those in power in the government, and the government tends to be more moderate to conservative. So I think it's a good thing as long as they are fair. And if they're not fair, it's going to be known in this day and age with how transparent this society is. My problem with the media is that they do become complicit in furthering this destructive culture that exists in Washington, D.C. by focusing on too much on who's up, who's down, how it affects the next election, instead of focusing on who's right and who's wrong. And I think that that's a real problem. I think a lot of reporters will, if not publicly, at least in some publicly will, quietly acknowledge, that's a problem. And in a lot of ways, there are a number of steps that the national media is taking. to correct some of that, the fact checks and truth test and things of that nature, all positive steps. The New York Times and other papers hiring public editors to look at some of these things as well and encourage them to take steps in a different direction to where it focused more on the underlying truth of things rather than get caught up in all the petty politics that go on too often. But there's a lot that all of us can help push the media in that direction too by encouraging them to take those, continue to build on those steps and take steps in that direction. The other part of that was how intensive the censorship of the media was in this White House. As for me, I can speak for myself. I'm the kind of guy that if I have a problem with a reporter, I would tend to go directly to that reporter. If it didn't work out, then I'd go to their editor, but I'd let them know I was going to do that. I didn't feel like punishing reporters or anything like that. There were times when it did happen. I don't know that it was to a great extent, but certainly also in terms of access to the president, and this happens to a degree in any White House too, there are certain people that, you know, they're never going to get a sit-down interview with the president. The president's not, you know, if he did, you know, I would have been gone a lot quicker in this White House. But the third part of that question, I don't remember.
I don't either.
But we'll go on to the next. I was trying to write it down. But.
Sorry. The permanent campaign, you talked about that in your talk and in your book at great length. Could you go into that a little more detail? You talk about it as a permanent campaign for the last 16 years through the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. What is it? Why is it bad? And what other option is there besides a permanent campaign?
It's before, yeah. And as I said, I mean, Senator McCain talks about ending. I don't think you can end it. It's here to exist. I mean, as polling came into politics and the media, that started the effort towards the permanent campaign culture. And what happened was, I think really looking, when I went back and looked back and I gave a quick summary of this in one of the chapters, certainly with Nixon's administration, you started to institutionalize the politicization of the White House in the sense that new offices were created, the Office of Communications, the Office of Public Liaison, and other offices that were primarily politically focused. And so you started building a bigger political operation with inside the White House. And, I think the focus ought to be more so on deliberation and compromise than it is on the political side. And what happened over the years, you continue to build on that. We saw President Reagan took stagecraft to a new level. We took it to an even newer level than President Reagan did. And then the Clinton administration came in, and they certainly learned a lot of lessons during what happened in the 88 campaign, and they said, you know, we're going to answer every attack with a counterattack and punch back. We're not going to, you know, it's this whole politics as war philosophy that is created, and it's all focused on really one thing, and that's the next election and retaining or attaining power. And it's all focused on how do you shape and manipulate the narrative to your side's advantage. And so what happens is that deliberation and compromise get pushed further down the list. And we come into office and build, well, we have a whole new office that was created, the Office of Strategic Initiatives, which in a lot of ways did some positive long-term strategic thinking, but it was also a very political operation. And so the political operation continued to grow. And that's what I talk about is how influential that political side is. Now, whether or not your political advisors, the permanent campaign, people like Karl Rove didn't create the permanent campaign. It created people like Karl Rove. And you have this massive political influence on any president. You've got to take steps to minimize that influence and have a counterweight in place. One of the things I propose in the final chapter is a deputy chief of staff for governing that would be a statesman or stateswoman-like figure who is focused on transparency, promoting transparency internally, who's focused on reaching out across the aisle, working with Democrats or Republicans, depending on which party you're from, in the Congress, and focusing on making sure the tone is elevated, that you're not engaging in over-engaging in the political side of things, and someone that can stand up to the president and tell him he's wrong, stand up to the political advisor and have a positive influence on things, because you've got to constantly focus on that side if you're going to minimize the political influence.
You probably have had more access and are more public about your relationship with President Bush. Could you reflect a little bit on his strengths and his weaknesses, as you do in the book?
Yeah.
Multiple questions on that subject.
I did become close with the president. It goes back to our time in Texas together. There are a number of things that I think are strengths of his. When you are president, you do have to be a decisive person and a strong leader, but I think he's gone too far with it, because this president, and I think every president needs to be able to reflect and to look back while they're in office to make sure that they can correct mistakes and acknowledge mistakes. He's someone that's very disciplined. He understands the need to stay focused on bigger picture. He delegates, I think, too much. But, you know, you look at I've seen some of this in this current campaign with Senator Obama, very disciplined about staying focused on the big picture. And to a large degree, you need to be able to do that when you're president. One of the things I talk about in the book, too, is when the president would visit wounded soldiers or visit the families of the fallen. And they were very emotional, moving moments. And it's probably the only time when he'd be visiting a wounded soldier somewhere. And I talk about one specific example that sticks in my mind. I would be hanging in the back, following him along. There really weren't many other people around, maybe Mrs. Bush if she was with us. And he does this often. He visits with wounded often. He visits the families of the fallen as well. But it was probably the only time when I'd see him walk out of those settings where I could see a little bit of self-doubt in his eyes. Now it quickly evaporated. And one of the issues that happened was with the families of the fallen, and this is understandable from where they're coming from. Certainly our troops have done everything they've been called on to do and more, and they've been there longer than they should have had to be. But many of the mothers or fathers would look at the president and look him in the eye and say, and this was shortly after they lost their loved one, say, "You make sure you finish the job. You make sure my son or my daughter didn't die in vain." And it almost reinforced this attitude in the president of needing to stay the course, and gave him just the need to stay the course. There is genuine care and concern there. Despite the fact that the overall policy that led to that may have been misguided or was misguided.
Several of our audience members question the tendency of this administration, especially Vice President Cheney, to seek more power for the presidency. They suggest that they always thought that Republicans were trying to reduce the power of government, not increase it. How does this all fit together?
Yeah, that has been one of the vice president's pet projects, and it's something that they are continuing to push, but having trouble because of how unpopular this presidency is, and the fact that you now have a Democratic Congress that is exercising its oversight role as they should be, and questioning these things. Now they're not getting much cooperation from this White House. You know, one of the things that I learned when I was there, I held on to this belief in executive privilege. Well, I now look back at it and believe that it was more just a stonewall attempt on this White House, and it's a stonewall attempt with the Valerie Plame leak episode as well. There's no reason why you couldn't have those officials go and testify before Congress. It's not going to have a negative influence on the presidency. It's going to have a positive impact on this country for the better.
Let's talk about your book for a moment. It's an interesting question. The book is subtitled Inside the White House. What happened inside the White House and the Washington's culture of deception? Was that your choice of description, or was that the publisher's choice?
It was something we talked about with the publisher. It's something we all came to and agreed upon. I think part of the subtitle was more of my thinking when we came to that agreement. The whole narrative, so you understand this, the whole narrative is really focused around how did this presidency veer so badly off course. So there you come up with what happened.
The multiple questions about the current political scene, so I'm not going to ask you what your political persuasion is these days, but what should we look for? What should we be looking for in this election coming up? What are you going to look for when you decide who to vote for?
And I haven't made a decision. I'm going to look very closely at this election. I want to hear specifics from the candidates that go beyond. We know where they stand on, for the most part, on the big issues. I want to know specifics. I'd like to see candidates talk specifically about how they're going to go about in terms of dealing with Iraq and bringing it to a responsible end. No one's going to be able to do it with a quick withdrawal. That's just not going to happen. But I'd like to see at least some idea of where they're going to go with that. And they've got to be able to forge, hopefully, a consensus way forward to make that happen. I would also like to hear specifics about what I said earlier. You say you're going to change the way Washington works. You say you're going to move us beyond the permanent campaign. How are you going to do that? Because once you get in there, and there's certainly a lot of ideas. Congress needs to do some things too, but no one has a bigger bully pulpit or bigger platform from which to speak and make it happen than the President of the United States, if they're willing to first and foremost embrace openness, embrace candor, and then constantly strive to reach out and be transparent and elevate the discourse. We made some minimal effort in that regard, but those are the things. I want to hear specifics about how they're going to do that, and hopefully in some of these forums, particularly where they'll turn to citizens to ask questions, maybe people will ask those questions as well.
A large number of questions about you and your future and what you plan to do. Let me read a couple of the comments. Thank you for being candid and writing a book about the truth. How did you find the courage to write this, and how did your family and friends react to it? Another questioner says, how bad do you feel about having helped facilitate the lies and deceptions of the administration? You feel guilty. So a lot of passion in these questions, and I've strained out the worst of it.
Go to the two extremes there, I guess. In terms of the idea of the courage to do it, I mean, you know, a lot of people write this kind of book when they're retiring from their whole career. I felt it was important to share my experiences now. Well, one of the reasons, obviously, to learn from it. And it was tough. It wasn't an easy thing to go through. I mean, I did have sleepless nights as I was working through this book, writing it, and putting things down on paper. But when I came, and I delayed the deadline a couple times because I wasn't quite finished with it. I wanted to make sure I got it right from my perspective, that it was the truth as best I knew it. And I did. I did reach that. And I have no regrets about writing this book whatsoever. But in terms of those that say, you know, the courage to do this, I know it closed some doors to me. And, you know, hopefully it'll open up some new opportunities as well where I can continue working on what I talk about in the book. That's what I want to do. At least one part of it is continue focusing on how we can change Washington, whether it's in an academic capacity or some other capacity. That remains to be seen. Once I get through this period, I'll start thinking about that more seriously. My family's been very supportive. You find out who your true friends are at times like this. But it's easy to have the courage to do this when you come to places like this, when you run into people on the street and they come up to you and say, thanks for doing this, and they appreciate, you know, they say, we appreciate what you're doing. We know it wasn't easy. And it's not easy because these were people that I worked very closely with.
Unfortunately, we've come to the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, so let me ask
It'll
you this question from the audience. Does your book and story help young people to understand if politics and serving our country are noble pursuits, and if so, how?
I hope so. I dedicated this book to those who serve, and it's dedicated most importantly to those who are someday going to serve or want to serve in politics. I think there's a lot that they can learn more than anybody else from reading this book, and hopefully never lose sight of what's most important, and that's their loyalty to the truth and the loyalty to the American people. That is what they should never lose sight of, and I hope by reading this and learning some of the experiences that came to me or things that I learned in a very painful way, that they will. This was a whole political education for me, my time in Washington, D.C., and I hope I've been able to contribute in some positive way, particularly to those who are going to serve someday. And I look forward to continuing to talk to young people about these issues and helping them understand it. I've seen a lot of young people show up at the events that I've been going to asking these very questions. Thank you very much. I look forward to visiting with you.
Our thanks to Scott McClellan, former White House Press Secretary under President George W. Bush from 2003 to 2006, author of What Happened Inside the White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Question.